In our first story, Behind Mansion Walls, a perfect country manor.
It was a mansion in every sense of the word.
Holds a dark and chilling secret.
About where I was standing, there were human teeth.
And later, raised in riches.
From the time he turned 18, he got access to the Vesti millions.
Destined for disaster.
He cut her head off to hide the evidence.
I'm Christopher Mason. Charm and money go hand in hand. A winning smile can seal a multi-million dollar deal, but it can also send the unwary to an early grave. Beware the devils in disguise.
Stone fireplaces, crowned by exquisite chandeliers. This opulent country mansion is perfect for entertaining. And it has a famous former owner.
Indiana's most prolific serial killer.
Indianapolis, Indiana. The big Midwestern city with a small town feel.
Even though it's a large city associated with the Indianapolis 500 and other events, is really a small Midwestern town in certain ways. Very conservative, very family-oriented.
On the city's northern outskirts is Westfield, a district synonymous with prestige.
You can find houses that range in value in several million dollars. And I'm talking about maybe 30 or 40, $50 million houses.
One of those sprawling estates is Fox Hollow Farm. In 1993, it's home to Herb Baumeister, his wife, and three children. A mansion bought with the profits from his successful chain of retail stores.
It had a beautiful Tudor home, 18 and a half acres, long driveway. It was a mansion in every sense of the word.
It was very picturesque. It was a very nice piece of property.
Herb was said to be a devoted father. And that was something that was very important to Julie.
Herb and Julie appeared to live a fairy tale. But like the ivy climbing over the windowsills of their Tudor mansion, tendrils of disquiet crept into their marriage. The first hint that something was awry appeared just months after their wedding, when Herb was committed to a psychiatric hospital.
About 6 months after they had married, his father had him committed. And I remember asking her, you know, how she felt or what she made of that. And she said she just never asked.
Julie never discovers that Herb was once diagnosed with schizophrenia.
I think that's somewhat telling because over the years, there seemed to be a lot of things she didn't question.
Frank conversation isn't the only thing missing from the Baumeister's marriage.
She did tell me that over the course of what I believe was a 25-year marriage, that they actually had sexual intercourse 6 times. She never saw Herb nude, and she said it was because he was self-conscious, because he was so tall and thin.
But over the years, money makes up for the lack of passion, until that, too, becomes scarce.
Their financial success was declining.
The Baumeister's retail business empire begins to crumble.
I think that did put stress on their marriage.
To escape the arguments, Julie begins to spend more and more time apart from her husband.
She would take the children to a lake house that was owned by Herb's mother. And maybe she also welcome the opportunity to get some time away from Herb.
In the summers of 1993 and 94, Herb has Fox Hollow Farm to himself, with plenty of spare time. Meanwhile, in nearby Indianapolis, something strange is going on.
A number of gay men from Indianapolis had begun to disappear.
People were missing that shouldn't be missing.
One man who went missing was named Alan Broussard, and his mother ultimately contacted a private detective named Virgil Vandegrift to try and find out what had happened to her son.
Virgil Vandegrift has only been on the case a week when he's contacted by the mother of another missing man, Roger Goodlett.
Neither one of them had the typical things that you would think of, like cell phones and credit cards and things that you could look at to track.
And in 1990s Indiana, it seems being gay is akin to being invisible.
I think if it had been young blonde co-eds disappearing, young blonde college students, that would have been very different. Some of the victims' families tried to contact the police and the media, but they just weren't interested.
So Vandegrift and his team print missing persons posters to try and trace the men's final steps.
So we decided to take them into the gay community area and distribute them among the gay bars. And at that point also, we found out that there were a lot more missing gay people.
From 1993 to 1995, 10 homosexual men are reported missing from Indianapolis.
The gay community there was starting to be aware not only that men were disappearing, but that also their disappearances were being ignored.
Finally, the publicity pays off. Virgil Vandegrift gets a call from a frightened gay man.
And when he did call Virgil, it turned out he had a very interesting story to tell.
Tony Harris's story begins one night in August 1994.
He said that he was at one of the gay bars, had a conversation with a man there.
He had met a man in a bar who identified himself as Brian Smart. They started talking, and eventually Brian convinced this young man to come back to this mansion. Brian Smart took him into this house, but said, oh, there's no electricity. So he kept it very dark, and he said, oh, we can't walk around the house, but led him to the basement where there was, as he had promised, this indoor pool.
This man wanted to do asphyxiation,
which basically means choking someone while they're involved in a sex act and cutting off air and oxygen to the brain, which causes something of a rush.
Without realizing the peril he's in, Tony Harris submits to this dangerous sexual game.
And he allowed Brian to perform this act on him. But when he felt he was starting to apply too much pressure, he pretended he had passed out. And he heard Brian saying, are you there? Are you okay?
And then he surprised the guy by letting him know that he wasn't dead.
I'm sorry. It's okay. Just relax.
Tony Harris talks Brian Smart into driving him back to the bar. Shaken by the encounter, Tony telephones Vandegrift. telling him if he wants to find the missing men, he should start by finding Brian Smart.
This young man was immediately convinced at that point that Brian was involved in these disappearances.
There's just one problem. When Virgil tracks down local men named Brian Smart, none fit the description given by Tony Harris. The trail goes cold.
He pretty much disappeared, and there weren't more disappearances for a while, which sort of hindered, obviously, the investigation.
But Virgil Vandegrift doesn't give up. He's got a hunch that as long as this Brian Smart remains at large, men will continue to disappear.
Part of my training was profiling types of people that could commit certain crimes. I was convinced that we had a serial killer.
The well-heeled residents of Westfield, Indiana, normally expect to find manicured lawns and carefully trimmed hedges in their backyards. Not human skulls.
Not exactly normal.
It's the fall of 1994. And housewife Julie Baumeister is stunned by her son's discovery.
She was kind of startled, to say the least.
Can I keep it?
No!
But when Julie's husband Herb gets home, the mystery of where the skull came from is quickly explained.
She obviously asked him about this. And he said, oh, it was my father's skeleton from medical school. His father had been an anesthesiologist.
Who's that?
Somehow I'd get out into the woods. I think he had some explanation if somebody got into the garage or animals got it or what have you.
Julie just accepted what he said at face value, but it was a rather odd discovery.
Human remains in the backyard. An odd discovery with an even odder explanation. For the moment, Julie accepts her husband's word. But not everyone has such faith in the goodness of humanity.
When I looked at what our investigation was showing at that point, I was totally convinced that there was a serial killer involved.
Virgil Vandegrift is investigating the disappearance of men from Indianapolis gay bars. He's been contacted by Tony Harris, who believes he had a narrow escape from a man who could be a killer.
The guy gave him a name of Brian Smart.
But a search for men named Brian Smart leads to a dead end. So Vandegrift asks for details about the mansion where the encounter occurred. Where was it? And who lived there?
He could tell they were driving north into what he told us was rich people territory. He saw some horse farms, so he had an idea of where they were, but it was dark and he couldn't really see.
He also said that the property had a sign. It had something farms on it.
Tony remembers seeing some strange objects in the house.
This young man was able to walk around the house, and he saw some children's toys. He said, oh, that's kind of strange. And then he saw two different bedrooms, one that had women's clothes. So he thought, maybe he's a cross-dresser.
What he found also bizarre is he said it was kind of dirty and had mannequins all through the house. Some of the mannequins were in odd positions, like one was like it was getting something out of a cabinet. Another one was dressed up in a lifeguard outfit sitting on the edge of the pool.
Virgil Vandegrift presses the witness for more information. anything at all, and is told the property had a long, distinctive driveway.
We went and got aerial photographs of the entire area, looking for a large building that would be sitting back off the road with the curvy driveway.
And 20 miles north of Indianapolis, they spot a property that matches the description. Is this the dark, mannequin-filled mansion? An investigator takes Tony Harris for a closer look.
Nobody was home at the time, so he was able to get out and walk around the house. And he could look through the window and see that it had an indoor pool.
Tony Harris is almost certain that this is the property where he had his encounter with Brian Smart. But who owns it?
We researched the property tax records. We found out that the person paying the property taxes there was a Herbert Baumeister.
Herb is a family man. Local police can't believe that he has anything to do with the missing men.
Law enforcement agencies in Hamilton County, which is where the property is located, were just not cooperative at all. That was really slowing things down. At the time, I thought, well, they were just trying to protect some rich people in a high-class area.
Police say there's not enough evidence to question Baumeister. So Tony Harris gets some more.
About a year later, he was at one of the bars, and lo and behold, there was Brian, who obviously had been keeping a low profile, but there he was. And as he had been instructed to do by the police, he followed Brian out of the bar when he left, and he was driving the same car he had driven when Brian had taken him to this mansion. And he wrote down the license plate and gave it to the police.
Lo and behold, it came back registered to Herb Baumeister.
Indianapolis police visit the Baumeister mansion and find Julie home alone.
They knocked on the door, and they said they were there to investigate a homosexual homicide. She said, "What is a homosexual homicide?"
She just said, "No, that can't be," and didn't cooperate.
But then Julie remembers the skull that was found 2 years earlier. And in June 1996, while Herb is away at the lake house, she allows police to search Fox Hollow Farm.
We get to a place that there was a clearing, and she explained that's where she'd found it. While she was talking, or we were ready to walk away, one of the officers noticed a bone, and it looked like the humerus. I looked down, and there were human teeth, three or four, about where I was standing, with what appeared to be finger bones. And things get pretty exciting at that point.
Immediately, that became a crime scene. In the end, they found the remains of 11 different people.
Is this some special place where Herb would have been?
There were some remarkable occurrences during that search. In that evening on the news, they found a bone. One of the lab technicians out at Hamilton County Sheriff's, you could see her pick it up, and there's dangling from the bone was a pair of handcuffs.
The discovery of human remains sends chills down the spines of some local residents.
Eventually, when neighbors saw what happened, they told the police, "You know, we found some bones in our yard, too. And actually, there were so many, there was a creek that ran behind the house, and kids used to find bones there. And they found so many that it was known among the neighborhood children as Bony Creek, strangely enough. But they assumed they were raccoons or animals that had died."
Julie is overcome by shock at the discovery of the mass grave. But the police have more pressing things on their minds. Like, where are Herb and the children?
Actually, her daughters were with her, but their son was with Herb at the lake house that his mother owned.
Frankly, my thought was, she's safe, but is her son safe? I was really concerned about that. And in my own mind, I was thinking what I needed to do so I can retrieve the boy.
Julie's attorney, Bill Wendling, fears for what may happen if Herb hears of the discovery at Fox Hollow Farm. He arranges an emergency child custody order. It allows sheriffs to confront Herb at the lake house and take his son to safety. But they don't have enough evidence to arrest Herb.
But by the time the police went back to the lake house, when there was enough evidence to arrest Herb, he was gone.
Despite the thousands of bones in her yard, Julie Baumeister still holds out hope that her husband is not involved.
Julie Baumeister said, I'm not sure that Herb has done anything out here wrong. She said, because I thought, knowing Herb, I thought that maybe he'd kill himself if he was really involved in this. And he had, you know, if that hasn't happened, I don't know if he's involved in this. I thought it was kind of an odd statement, but, you know, she knew him better than me.
With Herb on the run, the discoveries at Fox Hollow Farm make headlines across the nation. And 8 days later, Herb writes the story's final chapter.
Mr. Baumeister had killed himself.
He left a rambling three-page suicide note that talked about the failing business and that his marriage was over and the problems he and Julie were having, but he made absolutely no reference to the killings or to any of the missing men.
But Herb's note does contain a final farewell to his children.
It was an odd statement, said that he was going to eat a peanut butter sandwich and then he was going to go to sleep.
That morning, attorney Bill Wendling is tasked with informing Julie of her husband's death.
Julie's reaction was, she knew, I'm there at 4:30 or 5 o'clock in the morning, that it was something substantial. And I explained to her that they had found Herb and that he was committed suicide. And the children were just coming down the stairs as I was trying to explain that to her. And of course, you know, she acted adversely to that information and was quite upset for the children. I was concerned about their mental well-being. I mean, it's a huge shock that's going on for those kids. And it was an emotional scene.
Soon after, Julie Baumeister and her children move out of Fox Hollow Farm. They turn their backs on the leaf-strewn yard, drive up the long, curved driveway, and try to start again.
She went from living in a million-dollar estate to literally seeing her life fall apart, her husband of 25 years be accused of unspeakable crimes, and before he could say anything, take his own life. But I believe she and the children have tried to rebuild their lives as best they can. She said to me at one point that whatever he did, that will not destroy the love the children had for their father. Whether that will remain true their entire lives, I don't know.
11 sets of bones are found at Fox Hollow Farm. Only 4 of the victims are positively identified. Herb Baumeister takes the secrets of how they died to his grave.
Police were never able to question him, never able to charge him. But there's little doubt as to what he had been up to. He was the most prolific serial killer in Indiana history.
From the start, Virgil Vandegrift believed a serial killer was involved. And Herb Baumeister turned out to be a perfect fit for the profile Vandegrift created.
So at the time, my profile said that it would be a white male, no later than the age of 40, that would be educated, married, had children, fitting within the community. No one would suspect that he would be a serial killer, not even his wife.
And according to Vandegrift, Herb's suicide also fits with the profile of a serial killer's psyche.
A true serial killer is, I'm in control, and you're not going to get any information because I'm in control. A true serial killer will take the information with him to the grave.
And it's not just Fox Hollow Farm's secrets that Baumeister might have taken to his grave. Many believe he may also be responsible for murders of homosexual men found in neighboring Ohio in the late 1980s.
Herb has been suspected of possibly being a serial killer known as the I-70 Strangler, which is named after a interstate that runs through Ohio and Indiana.
I had the opportunity to meet with and talk with investigators from Ohio. And it is clear to me that before Mr. Baumeister bought the property in northern Indianapolis area, that his victims would be picked up and then he would drive over to Ohio and get across the border and dump their bodies.
Perth, Australia has been called the most remote city on Earth. 10,000 miles separated from North America. Europe is 20 hours away by plane. For some, the isolation is intolerable. For others, it's part of the attraction. What better place could there be to hide from your past?
What are you doing? It's kind of odd. Who he is, what he had done, and he's here and nobody knew it.
I'd used that term, your jaw dropped, many times in my life. I'd never actually seen it happen until I broke the news that this man had killed his wife and chopped her head off with an axe.
Erica Bedford has been a motorcycle lover her whole life. But back in 1980, there was one ride she wishes never happened.
We took this beautiful drive down to Sausalito, and we pulled up to the stop sign. And in the second lane to the right is a gentleman on a brand new Harley Davidson.
Lovely day for a ride.
The man straddling the glistening motorcycle.
Oh, I just love it out here.
Is a refined Englishman named Michael Telling.
He met me at Sausalito. Didn't know anything about him. He seemed like such a nice country gentleman.
Michael's more than a nice country gent. He's an heir to the billion-dollar fortune of the Vesties, Britain's second wealthiest family after the royals. With money like that, the Vesties usually get whatever their hearts desire. And what Michael desires is 18-year-old Erica.
He'd been so taken by Erica Zumsted that on that occasion, the first meeting, he bought her an opal necklace.
I said to my father that evening, he said, please, I don't want to hurt Michael's feelings. I like him, you know. But I'm not comfortable with this person buying me things, and I'd like to be his friend. So, Dad, could you talk to Michael and tell him I'd rather be his friend? And so Dad said, well, maybe, you know, my other daughter, you could visit for a little while.
Erica's sister, Monica, is 6 years older, and a recent journalism school graduate.
Within a week, he'd arranged for a meeting with the older sister, with Monica, and he transferred his first affections from Ricky to Monica.
William Vesty began his livestock and shipping empire in 1890s Liverpool, England. But his descendants are more likely to be found here, in the rolling hills of the Cotswolds, enjoying their 6,000-acre private sporting estate.
They certainly are still extremely rich family and also extremely close to the British establishment aristocracy.
Michael Telling's estate is in nearby Buckinghamshire. Known as Lamberne House, it's more understated, but still prestigious.
From the time he turned 18, he got access to the Vesty millions. He had a fabulous income. It was in the realms of about £30,000 a month.
It's into this world of wealth and privilege that Michael brings his new California bride, Monica.
And now.
I think it became pretty obvious to Monica very quickly that this was a man of enormous wealth.
So special. I'm so touched that you remembered. Thank you.
But it's not just vast sums of money that attract Monica to this British gent.
There is no doubt that Michael had some ability to present himself in a very beguiling way. He certainly told lots of fanciful stories about his past, and it appears that Monica fell for that.
Thank you.
Michael didn't have to work. Monica didn't have to work. She had tons of money to spend. A young married couple having a blissfully wonderful time. And the early days of their marriage sound terrific.
But wedded bliss is not to last. In less than 2 years, Michael is living alone in Lamberne House. He says his marriage is over.
Michael told everybody Monica had left him.
He would be telling them stories about how that she's returned to the United States.
If Monica has returned to California, why hasn't her family heard from her? And why does her sister Erica have an ominous sense that something is terribly wrong?
Suddenly, I felt the most violent feeling inside. Angry. And I didn't know why. It's March 29th, 1983. Suddenly, I felt the most violent feeling inside. Angry. I didn't know why. I didn't know what it was about till 5 months later. 5 months later, I got a call. Your sister's dead.
A week before that phone call, a man had discovered a decomposing body in an English forest. But identifying it proves difficult.
It was a headless corpse.
The discovery makes national news in Britain. In an effort to ID the victim, police release details of the clothing worn by the corpse.
The pictures of that clothing send chills down the spine of one reader. She last saw it worn by 26-year-old Monica Telling, wife of the Vesty heir, Michael Telling. Is it just a coincidence that no one's seen Monica for 5 months?
She contacted the authorities and said, you know, Monica's been gone a long time. That shirt looks very familiar.
near the village of West Wickham, police knock on the door of Monica's husband's mansion and begin a search.
And then in one of his favorite Mini Coopers, they uncovered, most gruesomely, Monica's head.
For 5 months, Michael had been telling friends that his wife had left him. How will he explain her severed head in his car? And just what brought this love story to such a brutal end?
This good-looking, charming young English gentleman, and this vivacious young American woman, and that should be a recipe for a great romance. What would end it? Tragically and fatally.
Police question residents of West Wickham and discover that in the lead-up to Monica's murder, all had not been rosy at Lamburn House.
The stories in the village of their wild parties and their drinking were fairly legendary, so there was obviously a fair bit of abusive alcohol going on. They were having a wild time, so there was plenty of booze and, by some accounts, plenty of drugs. And it just progressively started to work down.
The life of excess reveals another side to Monica's English gent.
I don't think I've forgotten about you either!
She ended up with a man who was able to explode into these disastrous tantrums and be very threatening towards her.
Michael has a history of mental illness.
He was definitely in psychiatric institutions from a young age. He had a propensity for violence. He attacked his mother with a carving knife at one point and definitely had mental health problems, no question about it.
Some say his wife tried to help him through his psychiatric problems.
Do it right here on the bench. Love.
Others, that she made his condition worse.
What he said is she taunted him mercilessly, he claims, about his sexual inadequacies.
Can we do that? Yeah. No, we're not gonna do that. You're too boring.
When police find Monica's head in the trunk of Michael's car, he admits he killed her 5 months earlier. But why? What pushed this refined English gentleman over the edge?
The Monica that was portrayed by the defense, this was a gold-digging, drug-taking, bisexual abuser.
In June 1984, a car containing British multimillionaire Michael Telling arrives at Exeter Court. He admits to killing his 26-year-old American wife, Monica. But so far, the world doesn't know how she died or why.
Michael Telling was able to get the very best defense team. And that defense team set out to make sure that Monica was portrayed in a very bad way.
Michael's lawyers try to prove he was driven to kill by his wife's behavior, and they present a defense Michael. That will shock the court.
See, you're so nasty.
Like this.
There was an elaborate story told about lesbian encounters, about him being embarrassed, that she was pushing into his face and constantly taunting him. And that was the defense that he took to court.
The Monica that was portrayed by the defense, this was a gold-digging, drug-taking, bisexual abuser.
According to the defense, it was years of this abuse that compelled Michael to snap one day in March 1983.
Marriage? Ooh, you've got your little gun, Michael. What are you gonna do with it, shoot me?
All we know is what Michael said in the court.
Why don't you shoot me? Hit me right here.
There was a confrontation. She was taunting him about his sexual behavior.
I do it right here on the bench, Michael. No, you wouldn't do that because you're too boring.
You can't stand him.
Come on, shoot me right here. I dare you.
He lost it. He snapped and he shot her.
Come on. Come on, what are you waiting for?
Shut up!
Psychiatrists testify that Michael was driven to murder by an irresistible impulse.
What they wanted to do was to make sure that he wasn't convicted of murder, that in fact, the jury would come back with a verdict of manslaughter through diminished responsibility. The way that they did that was to assassinate the character of Monica.
The portrait painted by the defense is one that Monica's sister, Erica, doesn't recognize.
She wasn't a failing, blubbering drunk. She wasn't a money grabber. She wasn't a lesbian. None of it's true.
Monica's family believe that Michael planned the thing meticulously. That he bought the gun with the express purpose of killing Monica, and that the way that he then treated her body afterwards and the eventual dumping of it was part of a plan that he had well before he shot her.
As far as I'm concerned, my feeling is it was premeditated and it was murder.
You, ungrateful, common, social climbing tart!
To many, Michael's actions after the shooting are more shocking than the killing itself.
And then he took her body. I think he moved it to one of the bedrooms. Then he moved her body to the sauna. She sat there for 5 months. Somewhere at the end of 5 months, I don't know why, Michael decided he better remove her body. He took her body 130 miles away to Exeter, and he dumped her body. And right there is where he decapitated her. He took an axe and cut her head off.
Michael took the head back to his home in Buckinghamshire with him.
Michael later says he did this because he wanted part of his beloved wife with him always at Lamburn House. But is that the real reason?
This was either a expression of his still undying love for her, that he wanted to keep a part of her, or it was a way of avoiding the dental records if the body was found, so that it would make it more difficult to identify the body.
Michael didn't cut her head off because he couldn't do anything to her head. He cut her head off to hide the evidence.
The court hears that in the 5 months between killing Monica and dumping her body, Michael takes other steps to avoid detection. He uses Monica's ATM card to make it appear that she's still alive, and even hires a private detective.
My wife's gone missing.
To look for her.
I need you to find her.
Michael Telling set out a very clever false lead. He hired a private eye and set the private eye to work, allegedly looking for his missing wife.
There is evidence that Telling concealed his crime and that it may have been premeditated. But in June 1984, a British court acquits him of murder.
But he was found guilty of manslaughter due to diminished responsibility. He was given a life sentence.
Even in prison, Michael allows himself little luxuries. While he was awaiting trial, he had sizzling steak dinners delivered to his cell and washed them down with a glass or two of claret. Now he's a convicted killer, those privileges are curtailed. But he can take solace in the fact that even while he's behind bars, his wealth is booming.
While in prison, he was still having money into his bank account from the trust. And this is substantial amounts of money, running probably into millions.
In Great Britain, a life sentence in many cases means just 10 years in prison. Michael Telling is released in 1994.
Within weeks, he had left the country, traveled to Australia, and bought a $750,000 Australian dollar house.
Michael begins an anonymous new life in a new country. No one uncovers his dark past until 2009. When journalist Paul Murray receives a tip.
I got an email from a person who reads my column in the newspaper saying that she had a story to tell me about a man who had recently died and he had a fascinating past and that I should look into it.
Soon after Michael Telling's death from diabetes at age 59, his face once again graces a newspaper's front page.
Well, they found out about his past when my story made page one of the newspaper. Everyone who knew Michael Telling in his time here in Perth, yeah, they got to know about it.
News of Michael Telling's demise does little to soothe Erica Bedford's loss. A loss she believes she sensed back on March 29th, 1983.
I felt Monica. I felt her die. People think that's crazy. I don't give a rats, you know what? Because I literally felt the fear, the horror, the trauma.
But this man had the capacity to do that to someone he'd fallen in love with only 2 years before and brought to the United Kingdom to have a wonderful life together. That's the thing that absolutely shocked everybody.
On the surface, they had it all. Money, charm, and grace. But deeper down, a dark side was waiting to burst forth. Herbert Baumeister's family man facade concealed a lethal lust. And when Michael Telling's mask slipped, he was anything but a well-mannered gent. Wealthy on the outside, wicked on the inside. Malice hid beneath the skin of these devils in disguise. Till next we meet behind mansion walls, I'm Christopher Mason.